From the KGOU studios, I'm Suzette Gorelott, the Dean of the University of Oklahoma's College of International Studies, and welcome to Worldviews. Joshua Landis and I talk about attacks by self-proclaimed Islamic State militants near the Turkish border, and the Syrian government's ability to focus on battling rebels because the United States is devoting its energy to combating ISIS.
If they were to be overrun by rebels, there'd be millions more refugees flowing out of Syria. They would go to Lebanon and Jordan. Those two countries could collapse.
Then I'll talk with Ron Burton. He's a Norman resident who just finished a year-long term as the president of Rotary International.
And if we can certainly bring different points of view and different political philosophies and religious philosophies and that sort of thing, surely we can carve out a solution that will be beneficial to all.
We'll talk about the International Civic Organization later this half hour. But first, these news headlines. This is Worldviews. I'm Suzette Gorelott. Joshua Landis, we have to return to what's going on in Syria this week. So ISIS attacks on the Turkish border, Syrian-Turkish border, they're threatening to overtake a city in a Kurdish part of the territories there. So this is raising all kinds of concerns and particularly disagreements between the United States and Turkey, allies that don't necessarily agree on how to handle the situation. So what are we to do? What do we make of this? This could be another international incident if things are to spill over into Turkey.
Well, Kobani would not seem to be important. It's a city of about 250,000 people on the border between Syria and Turkey. As you say, it's a little bubble that goes down into Syria from the Turkish border. It shouldn't be important, but it has become vastly important because it's a sign of our inability to get along with Turkey, to agree on what we're doing in Syria. It's our first major challenge in Syria, and it's not working. And it shows the vulnerabilities of the United States' attempt to destroy ISIS from the air, because the Turks have refused to allow other Kurds or their own soldiers to go in to save this enclave of Kurds. America has been demanding that they go in and lend support or at least allow other Kurds to reinforce them. Turkey said, no, we will go in and save it if you agree to take out Assad in Damascus and that we can come to agreement on what the hell we're doing in Syria.
So just to refresh our memories, the Turks don't want us to go in and assist the Kurds because obviously the long history of a Turkish-Kurdish conflict, latent conflict.
Absolutely.
Obviously, the Turks are concerned about terrorist activities from the Kurdish territories. So this is the hesitance they have. They don't want anyone to help that Kurdish population, but they're willing to just cede that territory to Islamic fundamentalists.
There are two problems here. One is that this reminds everybody of 1990. Remember, when we finished the Gulf War of 1990, Saddam Hussein began to reconquer the Kurds of Iraq, and this giant exodus took place back into Turkey of Kurds fleeing the mountains. It looked like a biblical scene. President Bush the Elder said, we can't have this. He drew a line on the 36th parallel and he says, no Iraqi planes north of that, no fly zone. And that was the beginning of an independent, quasi-independent Kurdish state in Iraq, which today has its own army, runs itself, its own flag. The Turks are worried that the same thing is going to happen in Syria if America really defends this. And it's different. They have grown to like Kurdistan in Iraq, which has become a bridgehead in a sense for Turkey in the Middle East. But the Kurds of Syria are controlled by and allied with the PKK, the Kurdish Workers' Party of Turkey, which is led by Öcalan. It has led the struggle for Kurdish autonomy in Turkey for 40 years. 30,000 people have been killed in this low-grade insurgency. The head, Öcalan, of this movement is in jail in Turkey, and Turkey does not want to reward these people. They see them as terrorists. America has listed the whole group as terrorists, so America can't be helping them, or we're going against our own laws. So it's a conundrum, and it underlines how difficult this entire operation in Syria is going to be.
Well, so this conundrum, though, is leading to this very challenging situation where the U.S. and Turkey, as you mentioned, disagreeing on Assad. So here the United States is distracted by ISIS and what's going on here in the Turkish border. So what this is allowing Assad to do is to regroup, and more or less it empowers him. So it's doing exactly what the Turks don't want to happen. They want Assad out, and the United States doing what it's doing is keeping Assad in power. And so this dilemma is all the way around.
It is a dilemma all the way around. And the rebels who we said, the Syrian rebels who we said we're going to partner with, are furious at us. They say, why aren't you attacking Assad? You're attacking Sunni Arabs. And you're not attacking Assad. You're helping Assad. And it certainly looks that way. Now, there is an element of truth to that. America does not want Assad to be overcome by the rebels, because there are 1,500 rebel militias. If they were to descend on Damascus and the many other cities of Syria that have been only lightly affected by the war, and some of them not affected by at all, if they were to be overrun by rebels, there would be millions more refugees flowing out of Syria. They would go to Lebanon and Jordan. Those two countries could collapse. And America does not want the chaos and disorder to expand in the Middle East, because that would lay the foundations for ISIS's and Al-Qaeda's spread in much more of the Middle East. So we're damned if we do, and we're damned if we don't.
We will undoubtedly return to this issue, Joshua. Thank you very much for being here today.
Thanks for asking me.
Let us know if you have any questions or thoughts about this discussion. Joshua Landis regularly posts articles and commentary on Twitter at @Joshua_Landis. And there you can also find a link to his widely read blog, Syria Comment. We're on Twitter as well, at @WorldviewsKGOU. And I tweet at @SuzetteGrelot. After a short break, I'll be joined by Ron Burton. He's a Norman resident who just finished a year-long term as the president of Rotary International. I'm Suzette Grelot, and you're listening to Worldviews. This is Worldviews. I'm Suzette Grelot. My guest, Ron Burton, joined the Norman Rotary Club in 1979. He has just finished a year-long term as the president of the International Civic Organization. The native of Duncan spent most of his career at the University of Oklahoma. He joined the staff of the OU Foundation as an accountant in 1969 and became the organization's president in 1978. He led the foundation for nearly three decades before retiring in 2007. Ron Burton, welcome to Worldviews.
Thank you very much. I'm delighted to be here.
So let's just start by telling us what Rotary International is, what it does, and we'll go from there.
Rotary International is an association of about 34,000 Rotary clubs around the world with 1.2 million members approximately. And Rotarians, men and women, are folks in each community that really care about the world. And they do all kinds of absolutely wonderful service projects to make their communities and, again, the world a better place to live.
So when they engage in service projects, are these – so because it's Rotary International, so it's international, obviously, because it's an international organization, as you mentioned, 1.2 million members around the world. But the service projects, do they have an international focus? Because I know you do some work with international students, for example.
Some of them do. You know, I think the greatest thrust that Rotary has is starting in being a local organization to address the needs of the community. And what happens and what has happened over the years is we have gotten together as a group of Rotary clubs and as an organization, for example, to eradicate polio from the face of the earth. And we have been 99% successful in that effort. We started this 25 years ago. No one thought it would take 25 years. We have three endemic countries left, but we have the number of polio cases down to 176 this calendar year, when back 25 years ago we would have 350,000 to 450,000 cases a year. So depending on the project, Rotary clubs do work together, but they also work alone, and that's the beauty of it, because it really gets back to the individual Rotarian.
Well, how did this program even start? Where does Rotary come from? Somebody's vision obviously said, hey, let's create a civic organization, a service organization that will spread around the world. So where does it even come from? What's its history?
Well, in 1905, a lawyer in Chicago named Paul Harris was living there, and he was to some extent, I think, a little bit lonely. But he was also looking, as a lawyer, to probably expand his business. So he invited three friends that were from different vocations to join him on a Tuesday evening in Chicago on March 23rd, 1905, to get together and just have a social hour. And they decided early on that what they would do is they would rotate that meeting among those offices. Thus, the name Rotary evolved. And over the years, in 1910, the first international club was established in Winnipeg, Canada, and it just continued to grow like wildfire.
So literally just kind of word of mouth and people just connecting to one another, the idea spread that we would engage in community service from community to community to community and connect. I mean, how do these different Rotary clubs connect? I mean, there are four of them here in Norman. Do they connect to each other? Do they connect to others? Or do they have sister organizations? How does that perhaps work?
They do connect. We do work with each of the clubs in town. They work together on certain projects, but they also work with other clubs in other states and in other countries, depending on what the project is. My club, for example, which is the oldest Rotary Club in Norman, founded in 1919, has done water projects in Central America, Latin America, and we've partnered with clubs in Houston. Of course, on the international projects, you have to have an international partner. And while in Oklahoma we have our own ideas about Texas, Texas really is not a whole other country and it is not international. But, you know, it just depends on the project. And there's a lot of involvement among Rotary clubs around the world. And we do have sister clubs, you know, and that's a club decision.
So when your organization here in Norman decided they wanted to work on water projects in Latin America, I mean, where does that come from? Does somebody within your group says, I have an idea, or are you searching for particular projects? How do you make that decision and then create that contact in order to get it done?
Right. Well, Rotary International at our world headquarters in Evanston, Illinois, has staff members who actually work on cataloging projects, you know, where Rotary clubs can submit information about a project they would like to partner with someone on. So you can actually go to that source and find a partner if that is something that your club is interested in doing. And, you know, there unfortunately, as we say, when someone says, what are you going to do after the eradication of polio? It's same with these projects. There's no shortage of opportunities because there's a lot of needs in the world.
Well, one of those needs, of course, is support for students. And one of the things I know has been very important to international students has been the support of Rotary scholarships to help bring them to the United States and help them study. I know one of my best friends in graduate school was a Rotary scholarship winner. But these are projects that are funded by your membership. This is a voluntary organization where people commit their time and their money to help solve problems and help young people around the world, right?
So absolutely. You know, our scholarship program has kind of evolved over the last several years to the studies in peace and conflict prevention and resolution. We have six universities around the world where we have graduate level programs in that. Five of them are a two-year program. And one of them, the one at Chula Longhorn, Thailand, is actually a short-term program. And we select about 60 students a year, and it's a full free ride for 2 years to study peace and conflicts prevention and resolution. And because that is one of our six areas of focus for our Rotary Foundation, you know, we honestly believe that if we can open the communication lines. And I know some people say, well, that's extremely naive, but if you can get people talking with each other and working with each other, we believe you can eliminate conflict.
I'm speaking with Ron Burton, the most recent past president of Rotary International, who's been an active member of Norman's chapter for 35 years. More of our conversation right after a break. I'm Suzette Guerlat, and this is Worldviews. You're listening to Worldviews. I'm Suzette Guerlat, the dean of the College of International Studies at the University of Oklahoma. My guest is Norman resident Ron Burton. He just finished his term as the president of Rotary International, and just before the break, he described a program in Thailand to study peace and conflict prevention. So let's talk a little bit about that then. Rotary International as a civic organization, a member of global civil society, if you will, that, you know, if I'm hearing you correctly, contributes to greater understanding, greater awareness, cultural exchange to the point that this leads to greater political, economic, social relations around the world. Can you tell me from your experience, and particularly maybe as your experience as president of the organization, of the international organization, some of the evidence you've seen of that and the impact that Rotary has made, not just to specific individuals or on specific projects, but just, you know, general, overall, greater relations around the world within that global community?
When Rotarians come together, like we just had our Rotary International Convention in Sydney, Australia, which was a tremendous success. It was actually my convention. We had 18,608 paid registrants from 160 countries around the world. And it's not unusual at our banquets to see every religion that you can name sitting at the same table, enjoying a meal together, discussing the issues of the day, discussing how they can work together to improve relations, discussing how they can work with other organizations such as the United Nations and others, and especially governments, to open the communication lines. So, it's sort of a one-on-one thing. It's one thing to stereotype a group of people, and it's another thing to get to know them. And Rotary chooses to get to know them and try to come to some common ground and work together to achieve our objective, which is, in this case, peace.
So a very important forum for discussing these issues and overcoming these barriers and obstacles and stereotypes. But you just mentioned working with the United Nations and governments. I mean, that was really where I was going to go next. How does Rotary play a role? Does it play a role? To what extent does it play a role in helping governments to open those channels of communication, to speak with one another, to overcome the barriers of intolerance and a lack of understanding?
Well, just to get back to the polio eradication campaign and give you a really, I think, great example, because of the respect that world governments have for Rotary, we have been able to broker ceasefires in some of the warring countries for polio immunization days. We have like four partners in the polio eradication effort, which we actually started. And the World Health Organization and Dr. Margaret Chan, who heads that up, will tell you if you visit with her. She's a really absolutely wonderful lady. But if you visit with her, she'll tell you that the world wouldn't be where it was today were it not for Rotary, because we put the boots on the ground. We got a lot of support from World Health. We've gotten a lot of support for Centers for Disease Control, from UNICEF, from the governments of the world, including especially the government of the United States of America, but also the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. They've given us $405 million for polio eradication.
So you mentioned just putting boots on the ground. I think that's a wonderful way to put it. Of course, we think of other things when we say putting boots on the ground. I mean, Rotary is in some ways kind of an army of people, right, that you send out around the world to solve problems that perhaps governments can't solve directly, or, don't necessarily have the resources to solve directly, or where you have just interested individuals that are much more likely to get it done. Is that kind
Absolutely.
Of where they're coming from?
The nice thing about Rotary is we're not interested in acquiring land. We're not interested in acquiring oil. We're not interested in acquiring resources per se. We're not interested in what your religious affiliation may be and trying to convert you to our way of life. What we're trying to do is to improve the quality of life for all human beings on the planet. And I think if we were communicating with each other and moving in the same direction, and if we can certainly bring different points of view into the mix and different political philosophies and religious philosophies and that sort of thing, surely we can carve out a solution that will be beneficial to all.
And much more likely to be accepted, it sounds like, by local communities, given your main interest is in helping provide for better access to health care or
Absolutely.
better standard of living or whatever.
Absolutely. I've actually been on National Immunization Days in India, and I've held Indian babies in my arms and given them those life-saving drops of vaccine. And that just rips your heart out. And you look in their eyes, and they're such beautiful children, and you know that you've done something very good. And, I know you helped them, but what it does for you is just amazing.
Well, and that clearly is what motivates, it sounds to me, over 1 million people to continue to be involved in this organization. Now, Just tell us, if you will, about your actual experience as president. You traveled the world, clearly. We were talking earlier that you probably know more people around the world than anybody else in the state of Oklahoma. So tell us a little bit about that term, how that was for you, what that was like, you know, and what are some of the highlights, perhaps, of your year as president of Rotary International?
Well, you know, you actually spend a year in office as president. You spend the year before as president-elect, and then you spend about 9 months of the year before that as the nominee. So it's really almost a three-year term. The last 2 years, you're required to operate out of world headquarters in Evanston, Illinois. So my wife and I just moved to Evanston. Rotary provided us with a condominium, and we operated out of Chicago O'Hare Airport because we were in the air most of the time. I think in the last couple of years on United Airlines, not to mention the others, but that's the preferred airline of Rotary for whatever reason, we flew in excess of 500,000 miles. But, you know, it's in many ways you see these rock stars on television, and certainly around Rotarians, the president of Rotary International, whoever that happens to be, is a rock star. I mean, everybody wants to see the president. They want to shake the president's hand. They want the president to come to their area and speak. They want to introduce the president to the heads of state. I know, for example, I was in Sarasota, Florida in February. I was doing a $1 million banquet for our Rotary Foundation, which is our philanthropic arm, which funds the scholarships we were talking about earlier, and also provides funding for our international projects. And I left there on Sunday morning. They drove me to Tampa. I flew to Newark and got on an airplane and flew to New Delhi, India. Got there about 1 o'clock in the morning. Got to bed about 3 or 3:30. Woke up at 6, went to breakfast. Went to the president of India's office. Presented him with the highest award that Rotary can give. It was a very nice personal relationship that we developed. We left there, went to lunch with a bunch of Rotarians, went to an auditorium about 3 o'clock in the afternoon. There were 5,000 Rotarians there, and we had Margaret Chan of World Health. We had Ms. Gandhi there. We had the president of India. We had the prime minister of India. We had the health minister of India, and we had Mrs. Suarez, who led the opposition at the time. And it was a national press conference in India, talking about the fact that we have now eradicated polio in India, which is just a huge, huge success. At the end of the presentation, the president of India comes over and shakes my hand. He doesn't shake anyone else's hand. I hosted dinner that evening for the health minister of India. I excused myself at 9:30 to catch a plane to fly back to Newark to Chicago. But just those kinds of incidents, I had an opportunity. I was supposed to have an audience with the Pope. Unfortunately, that didn't materialize, but I did get to shake his hand and visit with him for a brief minute. And that was really a nice, interesting thing to get to do. But I got at my convention, I got to spend about 15 minutes with Tony Abbott.
Well, what an experience, Ron. The work you've done is just really admirable, and we thank you so much for being here with us on Worldviews to share the work of Rotary International.
Thank you.
You've been listening to my conversation with Norman resident Ron Burton, who recently served as the president of Rotary International. You can find more information online at kgou.org. KGOU produces Worldviews through a partnership with the University of Oklahoma's College of International Studies. Brian Hardzinski produces the show, Sarah Hurd and Hallie Arias handle our digital presence online, and Symphony Swift prepares the research for our interviews and books the guests. For Joshua Landis, I'm Suzette Gralat.